Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Tom Williams talking about Viking Britain.
I think there are pros and cons to speaking at this time of the day, really. I mean, on the upside, I suppose you've all had a really nice day and full stomachs and happy and enjoying yourself. On the other hand, you may just all fall asleep because it's been so... We'll see how it goes. In any case, I want to start talking to you about Vikings by telling you a story. Don't worry if the names are unfamiliar or the places are unfamiliar. A lot of that will become clear, but it illuminates some themes that I'll go on to discuss with you in the rest of this talk. In 865, a great heathen horde, the Mickle Heathen Herre, landed in Britain. It was led by three brothers, Ube, Halfdan, and Ivar the Boneless. And these three fellows in the bottom boat, well, there are four of them actually. I couldn't tell you which one of them is Ivar the Boneless and which one's Halfdan. This depicts their fleet arriving, setting sail for Britain. It's not contemporary with the Viking Age. It's not contemporary with 865. This was produced in the 12th century, so it's much later than the events, although it's about as good as we get to a decent image of the Vikings as they were seen by contemporaries. When they arrived in Britain, the leaders of the great heathen army led it first to Northumbria, where they captured York. Here's an image of Vikings doing what we imagine Vikings did, slaughtering the inhabitants and stripping them of their clothes and generally being appalling and bloodthirsty. This essentially meant the collapse of the Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Northumbria. And I'll go back to this a little bit later on. Having knocked out the kingdom of Northumbria, the army again moved south, back to East Anglia, where they'd first turned up. They fought a battle, they defeated the East Anglians, and they captured its king, King Edmund. King Edmund, according to the story that was told in the 10th century by a monk called Abbo of Fleury, refused to surrender to the Vikings, refused to renounce his Christianity, and so they shot him full of arrows, cum asper herecius, like a prickly hedgehog. There we go. But this didn't do the trick. So he carried on praying, and he carried on proclaiming his belief in the Gospels. Eventually they got so irritated that they started to lash him, and they stripped the flesh off his bones. And I mean, it's ghastly, actually. If you read it, it's horrendous. That didn't stop him either. So eventually they cut off his head. Now, you'd think that would be enough. It wasn't enough. The head carried on talking and they carried on praying. So they tossed it into the bramble patch. That didn't stop it. It stayed verbose even in the bramble bush. And it was shouting out, "Hick, hick, hick, come over here," until the loyal East Anglians went and collected it and brought it back for burial. And of course, it then performed miracles and all sorts. This part of the story isn't necessarily true. We don't know. No, it might be. Don't know. The upshot, however, whatever we think of the story of Edmund and his martyrdom, was that the East Anglian kingdom had also fallen to the Mickle Heathen Herre. And these three characters, Ube, Halfdan, and Ivar, they fought on. Ivar died in 873. And Halfdan remained behind in York. Ube continued the war, eventually dying in 878 during the invasion of Wessex, where we are now. The rest of the army was led by a guy called Guthrum. We don't really know much about Guthrum, other than that he was one of these Viking warlords. But in Wessex, the Vikings met their match. And the army was defeated by Alfred, King of Wessex. And that really stemmed the tide for the time being. And again, we'll go back to this again. Now, what's really interesting is the aftermath of this, because Guthrum, in the sort of, I suppose, peace talks that followed on from his defeat, agreed a number of conditions with Alfred. He agreed, firstly, that he would become Alfred's godson, which effectively put him into a subservient role. He acknowledged Alfred as his father. He also agreed to start being called something else. He agreed that he would now be called Athelstan. And he also agreed that he would be baptized as a Christian. So this is quite a turnaround in identity for Guthrum. So off he goes, after this peace treaty, back to East Anglia, where he now rules as king of East Anglia, presumably with Alfred's blessing. The first thing he does, on returning back to East Anglia, is to start producing coins. Now, up to this point, no Vikings in England had ever used coins as coins. They'd not produced any coins themselves. It wasn't something that the Vikings did. It was something that Christian Anglo-Saxon monarchs did. But Guthrum does it, or I should say Athelstan does it. Coins like this were identical copies of Alfred's coins, except that they say Athelstan. I don't know if you can, but it starts with a cross, Edelstanre. Edelstan Rex, King Athelstan. So here we have the leader of a Viking army, the pagan leader of a Viking army, who in a matter of months has gone from being a pagan warlord to being an Anglo-Saxon Christian king, to all intents and purposes. Oops, sorry. In fact, when he died in 890, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle remembered him very fondly. And even more remarkable is what happened after his death. Now, this is a coin produced in East Anglia, presumably by Athelstan's Guthrum/Athelstan's descendants. And these are coins that were produced in the name of Edmund, the former king. They're identical to Edmund's normal issues of coins, with one exception, and that is the SC at the beginning of his name. And the SC is a contraction of Sancti, Saint Edmund. And this is really extraordinary, because what you have in these coins is the evidence that within a single generation, the Vikings who'd invaded East Anglia, who'd horrendously martyred Edmund and cut off his head and flayed the flesh off his bones, were now venerating him as a saint. So the conversion is complete, the transformation is complete. Those Vikings are now seeing themselves and wanting to be seen as Christian, as Anglo-Saxon, as integrated as you can be. The reason I tell this story is because it really goes to the heart of the two sort of aspects, the two key aspects of what the Viking Age in Britain was all about. Yes, it was violent. Yes, it radically redrew the geography of Britain. And yes, the Vikings were bloodthirsty. They could be bloodthirsty. They were pagan. Those elements of the stereotype can emerge unscathed. On the other hand, we see an amazing capacity for radical transformation in a very short period of time, and the degree and the speed to which Vikings could become visible, essentially, within the British population. Or if not invisible, then something new, something else. Okay. So, first principles. It's worth spending a moment just thinking about what we actually mean or think we mean when we talk about Vikings, because it's such a loaded term. Yeah, The Viking stereotype is a remarkably powerful one. It's incredibly enduring, and so many of its tropes, there's no way we're ever going to get rid of them. And a lot of people, when they think of Vikings, will think of something like this. You know, big, brawny barbarians with furry pants and ships and double-headed battle axes and all the rest of it, horned helmets. this is an extreme example, I should say. This. I choose it for that reason. And actually, if you were to pick this apart, there is not one single element of this image which is accurate to the Viking Age at all, apart from the sea and, you know, the ships. But the ships didn't look anything like this. They didn't have double-headed battle axes, and they certainly didn't have horn helmets. Most of them had skin. This guy doesn't have any. But nevertheless, this sort of thing really, really endures. The word Viking as well is a problem, because hardly anybody called themselves a Viking in the Viking Age. And I should say, when I say Viking Age, I'm talking about a period from about 800 to about 1100, and you can quibble with both of those dates. In Britain, I would argue that the Viking Age stops a lot earlier, but we'll come on to that. But the word Viking itself is hardly ever used. It appears twice in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle over that 300-year period. It occurs a few times on Old Norse in Old Norse inscriptions, sometimes as a personal name. It occurs fairly frequently in Old Norse saga material, which is much later than the Viking Age, normally to describe people who are up to no good. It's a sort of a pejorative term. The Vikings are the sort of people that Scandinavian kings need to go and deal with. Oh no, there are Vikings, the king is going to go and sort them out. It doesn't really ever refer to the sort of people we tend to use the term Viking to describe, i.e. anybody that comes over here from Scandinavia during that period, or anything Scandinavian from that period. Actually, when we look at it, there's a huge range of words that are used to describe Vikings. We have the most common one in Anglo-Saxon sources is Dane, which doesn't mean someone from Denmark. It means someone who speaks the Dansk Tongu, which means the Danish tongue, which is basically anyone who speaks foreign. So Dane is the most common one. We also have Northmen, Gentiles, in Gaelic, Fingal, which means fair foreigners, Dubgal, which means dark foreigners. Amount of ink that's been spilt on trying to work out what those two terms actually refer to. Pirate, Rus, if we're in the east of Europe, Scythian, Varangian, Heathen, Ashman, which is rather wonderful. But Viking, not so much. So we have to kind of come to a pragmatic decision when we talk about Vikings, that we're going to use it in the way that makes most sense to us, which is, generally speaking, to describe the activities of people coming from a broadly sort of Scandinavian milieu during those dates, doing certain sorts of things. That's nice and vague, isn't it? So where do they come from? So I touched on this already, but what the Anglo-Saxons thought about this is slightly harder to discern, because it's one of the earliest maps in existence of this part of the world, of Europe, at all. It dates from about the year 1000. There are some earlier Roman maps, but they're copied much later. In its original form, this is one of the earliest maps in existence. Now, you have to sort of turn your head to one side to make sense of this, because Britain is down here, right? So these are the Northern Isles, and that's Ireland. When you do that, it makes a bit more sense, actually. It's not too bad. But what you can tell is that when it came to the Northern world, they don't know what is going on. What's this? It's stuff. And ecclesiastical writers drew on classical tradition to explain this, and they had all sorts of names for it, Thule and Scythia and Hyperborea, and they were imagined as these sort of mystical realms, really, these places where monsters lived, dog-headed people, and it was essentially a place where where evil dwelt as well. You know, the ecclesiastical writers were well aware that it's where Satan had set up his throne, in the north. And we can get a sense of how people imagined it by looking back to what Abbo of Fleury says. Now, he's quite unambiguous about this. He says that from the north comes all that is evil, as those who've had too good cause to know, who through the spite of fortune and the fall of the die have experienced the barbarity of the races of the north. These, it is certain, are so cruel by the ferocity of their nature as to be incapable of feeling for the ills of mankind, as is shown by the fact that some of their tribes use human flesh for food. Clearly, Abbo thinks things that come out of the north are bad things, but he doesn't have the firmest grip on what those actually are. On the other hand, we know that outside of the ecclesiastical world, attitudes to the north were much more complicated. So Anglo-Saxon kings trace their lineage back through a succession of Scandinavian heroes like Beowulf. They share the same gods, although the Anglo-Saxons themselves have transmuted their gods into ancestors. They are the same characters, essentially. Some of the closest parallels for material culture in Anglo-Saxon England is found in Sweden. So this is the famous Sutton Hoo helmet from the ship burial in East Anglia. This is a helmet from a ship burial at the Vendel Cemetery in Sweden. So the Anglo-Saxons and the Scandinavians shared a great deal in common. They told the same stories. The same heroic literature was part of their shared heritage. Their languages are very, very similar. And so what emerges is actually a very conflicted and very complicated relationship of the Anglo-Saxons to their to the northern world. And actually, one of the things I argue in the book is that perhaps one of the reasons that they are so horrified by the Vikings is that the Vikings represented sort of a shadow image of themselves. They were the sundered kinsmen, you know, the dark cousins, the ones who never turned away from the darkness. The Anglo-Saxons had embraced the Gospels and they transformed themselves, but these others in the north, they hadn't. And that was profoundly disturbing, sort of a revenant way. Now, I talked about Viking being a term that we largely define by the things that Vikings do. And the first thing that comes to most people's minds when they think of Vikings are these violent raids around the coastline of Britain. And just to give you some context for what we're talking about here, this is Britain as it pretty much, well, it didn't appear like this, obviously, because they didn't have maps that looked like that. It would have been useful if they had. This is how we reconstruct the Britain of 800. The political geography, unlike anything that we're used to, for our purposes at the moment, the ones to be aware of in particular are East Anglia, Mercia, Northumbria, and Wessex, the four main Anglo-Saxon kingdoms of the time, but there are others. It's a patchwork, really, a patchwork of small kingdoms that wax and wane in power and had been doing so over several hundred years. But essentially the pattern was, well, it was constantly shifting, but it was always fragmented. Now the first Viking raid, the most famous of the early Viking raids, I should say, is the raid that occurred in 793 on the holy monastery of Lindisfarne in Northumbria, up here somewhere. I should use my pointy stick, but I don't want to get into that. And this raid has really become a bit of a leitmotif for how the Vikings have been remembered, largely because it sent such shockwaves through Christian Europe. Lindisfarne was a really famous monastery, not just in Britain, but all over Europe. And so when it was sacked in 793, it really did put the cat amongst the pigeons. Oh, this, by the way, is the image of what Britain looked like from a 12th century perspective. Being attacked by Vikings. It's a rather lovely image. But it's quite poetic, I think, this sort of shining citadel on this lovely little island surrounded by the sea, these menacing Northmen hanging around, predatory. So, what was I saying about Lindisfarne? So we have these incredibly lurid descriptions of what went down in 793. The first is a famous extract from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, and which describes how terrible portents appeared over the land of Northumbria, and the people were made wretchedly afraid. There were huge storms of lightning, and dragons of fire were seen flying aloft. These signs were quickly followed by great hunger, and a little after that, in the same year, on the 8th of January, the ravages of heathen men miserably laid waste God's churches on Lindisfarne Island by plundering and killing. So that sets the tone. Now, the rhetoric is amped up even further by Alcuin, who's a Northumbrian cleric, but working at the court of Charlemagne in northern France. He wrote a letter in which he said, "Lo, it is nearly 350 years that we and our fathers have inhabited this most lovely land," and he means Britain, not Francia, "and never before has such terror appeared in Britain as we have now suffered from a pagan race, nor was it thought that such an inroad from the sea could be made. Behold the church of St. Cuthbert spattered with the blood of the priests of God, despoiled of all its ornaments. A place more venerable than all in Britain is given as a prey to pagan peoples." There is some real truth to all of this. You know, it's hyperbolous and it's some of it's a bit ludicrous, but the evidence is there. If we look at what we find from Scandinavia, we find church treasures. We find book ornaments that have been prized off gospels. This is an example from Norway. It's a reliquary casket, so literally a box that was made to house the relics of saints. And on the base of it, it has a runic inscription. It says, "Ranveig owns this casket." Ranveig is a woman's name. And there's a debate about whether women fought as Viking warriors. And it's not a trivial debate. But somehow or other, this object has ended up in the possession of a Scandinavian woman, clearly not being used for the purposes that it was intended for. So we might well imagine, you know, the dusty bones of saints being emptied out over the side of the longship on the voyage home. I don't think that's far-fetched. And more valuable than things like this were human beings, human bodies. The most extraordinary thing, this is a piece of graffiti from the island of Inchmarnock in the Western Isles, and it shows, well, it shows a number of figures. The central figure is a large, appears to be a warrior. He's wearing a sword, he has chainmail on his body, has this amazing shock of hair on his head. There's another armored figure to his right, his head and body are broken away, and there's a ship, which admittedly looks like a sort of caterpillar or something. But you can see the oars, you can see the sail. The poignant part of this is the figure on the left-hand side. It's one hand outstretched rather plaintively. There's a chain running from the hand to the belt of the figure in the middle. There's what appears to be a rope connecting the sort of sketched-in head to the shoulder of the central figure. There's what appears to be a manacle around that wrist and a chain linking that to the body of this other character. And almost certainly, what this depicts are the very, very many slave raiding expeditions that were mounted by Vikings in the Western Isles of Scotland, in the Irish Sea, and everywhere else around Britain as well. We have very clear references in Irish chronicles to large-scale removal of people by the Vikings as loot, because they were incredibly valuable commodities. And we have some really visceral evidence for this slave trade. Now, this is from Dublin. You look at something like this, it is technologically, functionally identical to the sorts of objects that were used in the transatlantic slave trade. You go to Liverpool and you can see things like this from the 18th century, and they look exactly the same. So we have to remember, when we think about the Vikings and the Viking slave trade, this wasn't just, you know, taking a handful of people now and then from a monastery. This was a serious business, and it was happening in volume with technological sophistication to back it up. The proceeds of this were substantial. So this is a hoard from Yorkshire, it's the Vale of York hoard, and it includes objects which speak to a whole range of Viking activities. Ecclesiastical treasures, the cup is a pyx, certainly from an altar. There are Anglo-Saxon coins, there are wristbands from the north of Scotland, there's Slavic silverwork from Russia and Poland. And there are dirhams, Islamic silver coins, these large ones that you can see dotted throughout. Now, Islamic silver is found in greater quantities in Scandinavia than it is in the Middle East or anywhere else, for that matter. And this is what the slave trade was really all about. People were being transported by ship from Britain, from the rest of Western Europe, from Slavic lands to the east, through the Baltic, down the Russian river systems, to the Black Sea, to the Caspian Sea, and onwards. And we have written descriptions of slaves being transported as far as Baghdad. And what came back was an absolute ocean of silver coins. So this goes to another point, which is that when we think of Vikings, we often get sort of trapped, or scholars in the past have got trapped in trying to decide, were the Vikings raiders or were they traders? Because when you're dealing in slaves, when you're dealing in human beings, these are fine distinctions. They're not really distinctions at all. Quite conceivably, you're rounding up people from one village and selling them on down the road in the course of a single voyage. The slave trade is violence. So the Vikings can be all these things all at once, and it doesn't have to be an either-or scenario. Now, as I've already touched on, things really change in the mid-9th century. Things start to get serious. The Mikkel heathen Heather turns up in 865, other Viking armies as well. And the big difference now is that, unlike these hit-and-run raids, these armies stay. They don't go home. You start to get references to Viking armies overwintering in various places, often on islands, Thanet or Sandwich or Estuarine islands elsewhere, and also inland. And because they're staying, they're not going anywhere, they don't need They don't give the opportunity to the Anglo-Saxons amongst whom they've settled to regroup, to respond, and they can continue their raiding throughout the winter on into the next year. They've got a beachhead, they can gather reinforcements, it spirals and it spirals and it spirals. This is not a very high-resolution image, I'm afraid, but it's a depiction of the artist's impression of the Viking camp at Torksey, where the Viking army camped in the winter of 873. And it's enormous. It's about 65 acres. So this is a huge thing. This isn't just a little camp with a few ships and a few guys hanging out over the winter. This is a little town. There's archaeological evidence of women and children, of manufacturing, of trade. So this is a serious proposition. And we can start to see these big armies as almost like mobile communities that just move around the country. Now, it's been suggested that, these are like little towns and they're clearly trading. So they're trading with the locals. So they're integrated into the local communities. Well, yes and no. Yes, they're trading. But we get some insights into the sorts of things that they're trading from objects like this one. Where is it? This is a gospel book called the Codex Aureus. It's an 8th century book, so it predates the Viking Age. But what's really interesting, beautiful though it is the spidery additions at the top and the bottom. Now, these were made in the mid-9th century. and they say this: I, Ealdorman Alfred, and my wife Werburg procured these books from the heathen invading army with our own money. The purchase was made with pure gold, and we did that for the love of God and for the benefit of our souls, and because neither of us wanted these holy works to remain any longer in heathen hands. So when we talk about the Vikings trading with the locals, this gives some context to the sorts of things that they may well have been trading in. You know, the very things that they'd taken from a monastery down the road, they're now selling back to the communities from which they'd stolen them. And it presumably wasn't only gospel books. It would have been probably livestock, prized personal possessions, and quite conceivably your loved ones. You know. So, the Viking armies march on. In 873, they come to Repton in Mercia. King Burghred is driven out. It's the third Anglo-Saxon king they've disposed of. The third Anglo-Saxon kingdom that's wrecked beyond repair. Mercia doesn't quite disappear, but it's chopped in half and its king's driven out. It's a pretty good job. And of course, as we've heard, in 878, they invade Wessex. Alfred is caught short, retreats to the Isle of Athelney in the Somerset Levels. This is Athelney, this bit on this end. This is a photograph taken during the floods. I can't remember how many years ago now, but just to give you an indication, an idea of how it might have looked, or how it, you know, something that resembled how it may have looked in Alfred's time. And from here, he, you know, thought about his fate and worried about what he was going to do and set out guerrilla raids onto the Viking army, and ultimately was able to muster a force large enough to challenge the great heathen army at Edington. As we've seen, this is Edington, this is the edge of the chalk ridge, the other side of Salisbury Plain. There's the view from the rim. The modern town of Edington is just over there somewhere. Amazing place. And of course, as we've heard, Alfred was unexpectedly victorious and checked the Viking advance. The other thing, of course, that comes out of this defeat of the Viking army is the rapprochement with Guthrum, or Guthrum Athelstan. I won't go through that again, but the other important thing that transpires is what's known to historians, it doesn't have a name, but it's known to historians as the Treaty of Alfred and Guthrum, imaginative. But his most important clause, or most frequently cited clause, is the boundary between Alfred's territory and what's come to be known as the Danelaw. And he says, first concerning our boundaries, up on the Thames, then up the Lee, and along the Lee into its source, then straight to Bedford, then up the Ouse to Watling Street. Straightforward, there you go. And then you sort of have to fudge it at the top because it doesn't quite go that far. Now what it describes is nothing to do with the limits of Guthrum's power. It's actually got nothing to do with the limits of Alfred's Wessex. This is a total fiction, a legal fiction, dreamt up by Alfred to justify his ultimate claims to all of this stuff. You know, he'd never been king of Mercia. But, you know, stroke of a pen. Likewise, Guthrum had never been in charge of all of this stuff. This was just all those places up north where there were probably some Vikings still hanging about. We don't really know, but we won't push our luck here. But it's come to be seen as a defining demarcation of English and Scandinavian spheres of influence, which, as you'll see, in some ways it was. Now, what then happens over the following century or century and a half is the settlement of these pink parts of Britain, or England, I should say, at this stage, of these Scandinavian migrants. We don't have as much evidence for this as we would like to have. In terms of rural settlement, you know, if they built Scandinavian-type longhouses in the Derbyshire countryside, we have no evidence that they did. The places where we do have evidence are the places where they built in stone. So this is Shetland. This is a Viking Age longhouse from Unst. And you can clearly see the two rooms of the longhouse. It's stone footings. Prior to this, the inhabitants of Shetland and Orkney built roundhouses. And something happens that changes that. So this is good evidence for rural settlement. And this is how it would have looked, when it was new. In the absence of archaeology, we have place names. So each one of these blue blobs is a British place name with Old Norse origins of some sort. Some of these are hybrid names, Old English and Old Norse boshed together. Many of them contain familiar Old Norse elements like the BY ending. So Grimsby, for example, is an Old Norse name. The farm of someone called Grimmer. Thorps, a sort of a small farm. Thwaites, the clearings. All of these places have an Old Norse heritage to them. And you can see how the place name evidence has driven the production of maps like this. That is the evidence base for a large parts of Britain, where these people were and what they were doing. We also have urban archaeology. So this is the famous Coppergate excavations that took place in the 1970s and 80s in York. And they revealed a town that was absolutely booming. But it was booming with the influx of Scandinavian craftspeople and settlers. Fabulous waterlogged conditions. So you get this amazing surviving organic material, wattle fencing up at the top here, wooden footings of houses. Now, the thing to say about Viking York is that it may have been booming, but it's not somewhere you would choose to live. The top image is an artist's reconstruction of how it may have appeared. The houses, we know, were very, very close together. They were small, about 5 meters by 3 meters mostly. They were small, and they were very tightly packed, with small yards out the back. And we know that York was waterlogged because the archaeology is waterlogged and it still floods. So it would have been masses of stagnant water sitting in these lots out the back. These lots also provided the waste disposal system. So the Viking Age waste disposal system essentially was to dig a big hole in the back garden and throw your rubbish in that. And not just your rubbish, you know, all your rubbish, if you know what I mean. Now that's probably fine when you're first generation. When you get to the second generation, the third generation, you know, the ground you're digging through to dig your next hole is not necessarily what you want to be digging through. So the inevitable upshot of this is that pretty much everybody in York was riddled with internal parasites. We know this for a fact because we have fossilized turd, also known as a coprolite, which has been analyzed to show evidence of the huge quantities of parasitic eggs, worms, in other words. So it wasn't a nice place to be, but it was rich. And the other side of what we get from York is the amazing evidence for trade. This is a set of hand scales and weights used to measure out silver, measure out other commodities. Of imports, this is pottery from the Rhineland and Baltic amber. It's coming into York, clearly going through transaction, but it's also being worked. And we have extraordinary evidence of manufacturing as well. So the shoes at the top are real Viking Age shoes from York. So what I say about the condition, the state of preservation is utterly remarkable. And they were being made there. We have the tools, we have the products, we have the offcuts, and we have the finished articles. Combs, massive comb making industry, usually made from things like deer antler, often imported reindeer antler. Using Scandinavian techniques as well. So we can see the manufacturing, we can see the trade networks, we can see how York starts to fit into this wider Scandinavian world of imports of reindeers and Baltic amber and so on. They also start producing coins in York. We've got this sort of evidence of minting. This is a coin die, blanks, test pieces, and so on. And what we see from the coins is something else, something equally interesting, which is the convergence of different ideas and different imageries, different worldviews. This is a silver penny minted in the name of St. Peter, the patron saint of York. You can see S-C-I-P-E-T-R-I and then M-O, St. Peter's money, Sancti Petri Moneta. There's a big sword in the middle, clearly, the sword being a symbol of St. Peter. The really interesting thing is that the eye of Petri has been turned into a Thor's hammer. So this is not a native idea. No Northumbrian, Christian Northumbrian has thought, Thor's hammer, that would be good. This is a new thing. And there's a lot of speculation about why, what are they trying to do here? And one idea is that this is a way to educate these pagan people about Christian mythos. You know, St. Peter is a bit like Thor, you could say. Thor is famous for fishing. St. Peter was a fisherman. You know, Thor's a big burly guy, he's, you know, kind of tough. St. Peter's kind of tough. Yeah. And yeah. What I'd like to think about this is that if you're the Viking king of Northumbria all of a sudden, you're reliant on your position on two things, really. You're reliant on the Christian church, that provides the continuity with past rulers and gives you a native structure that the Anglo-Saxon Northumbrians can buy into. You're also dependent on your largely pagan Viking warband. So when you're designing the iconography for your official coinage, which is effectively your official propaganda, then bodging together some Christian and some pagan imagery is one way of doing it. And the fact that you can kind of equate the two characters probably helps a little bit. Now, this sort of thing is going on all over Britain. This is an inscribed cross slab from the Isle of Man. It's called Thorvald's Cross because it has a runic inscription up one side of it that says, Thorvald raised this cross. And on one side, you can just see the runes actually on that edge. On this side is what appears to be an unambiguously Christian image. I mean, we've got not a clue what it's supposed to represent, but it's pretty clearly Christian. You have a figure holding a big cross and holding a book and trampling on snakes. And if that wasn't enough, there's a fish hanging about as well. So, you know, we can be fairly sure. What, it might be St. Patrick. On the other side, however, is something rather different. Here we have a figure with a raven on his shoulder. I don't know, I will use the pointing stick. Raven on his shoulder. There's his eye, so he's facing this way. A spear by his side, and his leg is disappearing into the jaws of a wolf. Now, anyone that knows their Norse mythology will know that this is very obviously a scene from the Norse myth of Ragnarok, when the god Odin is devoured by the wolf Fenrir at the end of time. And Odin is famous not only for his ravens, but also for his spear, Gungnir. So here we seem to really have something interesting going on. This is the last gasp, in many ways, of the pagan Scandinavian worldview, but it's appearing in a context which is totally Christian. It's actually on a cross. So I think this is where you start to see the assimilation of the Norse cosmology into a Christian worldview, a rationalization of the Norse myths within a Christian framework. You could speculate that this is something to do with the end of the world, and then you'd have a nice sort of parallel between them. And this sort of cultural assimilation is happening in different ways and different places all across Britain. This is a brooch called the Hunterston brooch. It's from the west of Scotland, probably, maybe of Irish manufacture. It's hard to tell apart. Again, like the gospel book, it's 8th century. But what's interesting about it, I mean, it's clearly an amazing object, incredible investment of workmanship and precious materials. But what's interesting about it is that, again, it's been inscribed with a runic inscription on the back about 100 years later. And the inscription reads, Malbligtha owns this brooch. So what, you might say. The thing that makes it really interesting is that the language of the inscription is Old Norse. The alphabet, the runic alphabet that's written, is an Old Norse alphabet, but Malbligtha is a Celtic name. The object itself is a Celtic artifact. So here we have somebody who's speaking Old Norse, writing in Old Norse, but named in the Celtic tradition, and prizing and valuing something of Irish workmanship. And it's the beginnings of a new identity in the west of Britain that's neither really Viking anymore, but nor is it really native. It's something entirely new. Now, we're coming towards the end. But there is a fairly major coda to this story. So over the first half of the 10th century, from 900 onwards, Alfred's children, his son Edward and his daughter Ethelfled and his grandson Athelstan, systematically conquer the rest of what is now England. Now, I say conquer, but you often see this referred to as a reconquest, and it was absolutely nothing of the kind. Because Alfred's dynasty had never had any claim whatsoever to East Anglia or Mercia or Northumbria or any of these bits of England. But they present it as a reconquest from the Danes because, you know, that supports their narrative. But the ultimate end result of this West Saxon conquest of England is, for the first time, a unified country. And simultaneously, the Pictish kingdoms and the Dalriadan kingdoms of northern Britain also coalesce under much more mysterious circumstances, probably also with Viking involvement. So you reach a stage in the middle of the 10th century where you've, for the first time, you have a kingdom of England, a kingdom of Scotland, and a protracted period of peace, particularly under the English king, Edgar. It all starts to go wrong again in the 990s. There's a new king on the throne, Edgar's son, Ethelred, known to posterity as Ethelred the Unready, which is not really what his name meant. It's actually an Anglo-Saxon joke, it's Ethelred Unrad, which is a hilarious English pun, because Ethelred means noble council and Unrad means no council. So it's like, noble council, bad council, ho-ho. So it doesn't mean Ethelred the Unready, really. It means something like Ethelred the Ill-Advised, which he certainly was. It's during his reign that Vikings turn up again, most famously in 991 on the Blackwater estuary in Essex, where they kill the East Anglian ealdorman Blitnoth, defeat a huge English army that's sent out to send them packing. It results in one of the most famous monuments of old English literature, the Battle of Maldon, which is a great triumphant paean to total failure and calamity. And this defeat results in the fateful decision by the English to pay the Vikings £10,000 to go away. Which, you know, has the not entirely unexpected result of encouraging them to come back in 994 when they were paid £16,000 to go away. And then again in 1002, they were paid £24,000 to go away. In 1007, they were paid £36,000 to go away. 1012, £48,000 to go away. And in 1016, admittedly, this was after they'd been conquered already, so they didn't have much say in the matter, £72,000. Now, these are, I can't emphasize this enough, these are enormous sums. Unbelievable sums. There were 240 silver pennies of the type that I've shown you to the English pound. So £10,000 is 2,400,000 silver pennies. When you bear in mind that each one of those has to be whacked out by hand, it's a lot of labor, let alone silver, that goes into producing that kind of tribute. By the time we get to the 72,000 payment, in today's money, if you work on the basis that a single penny is worth about 20 quid, which is, seems reasonable, £345,600,000. That's a lot. That's a lot. Oh, this, by the way, this is a hoard of English silver coins from Denmark. It's called the Tyskegaard hoard. It's interesting because they've all been produced at exactly the same time. They've never been used. So this looks very much like the sort of hoard that is comprised of tribute money. All that's happened is one coin has been bent, probably to test its purity. You know, it's a kind of pirate trick of bending the doubloon in the teeth. There are more English pennies of this period found in Scandinavia than have ever been found in England. So it gives you some idea of the scale of this. Now, the Vikings didn't have it all their own way. Some of you may remember this from a few years ago, the mass grave that was discovered on the Ridgeway, the Dorset Ridgeway, 54 decapitated bodies thrown into a pit, a slightly smaller number of severed heads thrown into the other end of it. The carbon dating places this at around the year 1000, and the isotope analysis on the teeth indicates that they all came from the broader Scandinavian world. So these are Scandinavian men that have come a cropper in England. Quite how and quite why is another matter, but it's quite a ghastly end. I mean, what's interesting about them actually is that a lot of them don't look like they would have been capable or had ever done any fighting. So this may in fact reflect something more like a massacre. We know that Ethelred ordered the extermination of the Danes within his kingdom around this time. So this could equally be some sort of act of ethnic cleansing as much as a heroic defeat of some Viking warband. Ultimately, it goes wrong for England. Sven Forkbeard conquers England in 1013 and becomes king of all England, king of Denmark already. He doesn't last very long. He drops down dead within a few weeks. Sort of a bit of wishful thinking on the part of the English. They imagined that the ghost of the vengeful St. Edmund came back to get him, and that's what's going on here. If that is true, it didn't do them any good, because 3 years later, his son Canute came back and finished off the job properly. Now, I end my story really with Canute, and the reason that I do is because although he was undoubtedly a Scandinavian in some sense, he was the son of the King of Denmark. I mean, his mother was Polish, but that's another matter. He was light years removed from how we imagine those early Viking raiders to have been. Canute was a man who saw himself as a thoroughly mainstream European monarch. He was a Christian. He'd always been a Christian. As King of England, he took enormous pains to present himself as an Anglo-Saxon king. In this depiction of him, which is contemporary with his life, this is from the Winchester Liber Vitae, he's depicted with his English queen, who incidentally is the former English king's former queen. wearing a crown of the English style, presenting an absolutely enormous gold cross to the High Altar of Winchester, the new Minster of Winchester. We see the same in his coinage, we see the same in his letters. In the figure of Canute, Scandinavian Britain really hits its pinnacle, but at the same time, the Viking Age really is over. Those freelance raids, more or less, are becoming a thing of the past. You can go and see his bones in Winchester Cathedral. I can't tell you which of the coffins they're in, because during the Civil War, parliamentary soldiers emptied out all the coffins of English and Scandinavian and Norman bishops and kings and nobles, and threw them all around the nave and broke the stained glass windows with them. So naturally, when they did the cleanup, they didn't really know which bones went with which, so they just threw them all into different boxes and hoped for the best. But in some ways, I think it's quite a nice metaphor for where we end up in the 11th century, that all of these ethnic identities, which sort of seem so static when you approach the subject for the first time, by the 11th century, they've melted away to nothing. Totally jumbled. And I think I'll leave it with that thought, really, that as much as Britain had become a Viking country by the 11th century, the Vikings had also become thoroughly British. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.